Hey everybody, this is DJ Q for the Golf News Met Radio Network. We now return you to Jay's Place, already in progress.
Alright everybody, and a big thank you to DJ Q. Welcome back to the Jay's Place show on the Golf News Net Radio Network. Nice to catch up with everybody again. Hope you've been having a fabulous spring. It's been a really great spring so far on the PGA Tour between a terrific Masters win for Danny Willett and a fantastic win at the Players' Championship for Jason Day. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. Jay's Place is brought to you by KB's Best Hot Sauce. It's the boldest, it's the spiciest, it's the most flavorful, it is the best hot sauce out there. When it says JB's, it's the best. So everybody, we've got our own editor-in-chief and publisher and chief muckety-muck of the Golf News Net and all of its platforms joining us today. Ryan Ballengee comes back to chat a little bit. Ryan, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Jay. Thanks for having me on again.
Well, first and foremost, congratulations, everybody, on Masters Week. Well, it was a couple days after the Masters ended, actually. Ryan and his lovely wife, Katie, became parents once again to a beautiful, bouncing little baby girl named Rose. Congratulations to both.
Thank you. We are very happy to have Rose in our lives. She's a little over a month old now. She's a big baby when she came out. She's a big baby now, and hopefully that means we put a golf club in her hand someday. She'll hit it just as far as Lexi Thompson.
Now, you definitely get an award for the most clever, plays on words of all regarding this. Okay, word was that Casey was actually due on Master Sunday. And so not only did you quip somewhere along the lines, yep, planned that out well, but you made a shirt for your little son, Tarek, which says, let me see if I get this right, brotherhood doesn't begin until the back nine on Sunday.
Yeah, that was the going plan. I mean, that was what we were led to believe, that the due date was going to be Masters Sunday. Or, you know, we thought, okay, well, maybe she'll come early and it'll be sometime in Masters week. But she was a little stubborn and didn't come until 3 days after Masters week. So she waited a little bit longer, but that's great. We're happy to have her. We got to enjoy the entire Masters, even what happened to Jordan Spieth. And now we have a new baby girl, which is cool.
It's not very enjoyable what happened at Jordan Spieth. We didn't get a chance to talk to you about that. So let's take care of the Masters first. My opinion is that Jordan's going to be just fine. And it seems like taking a couple days off to go party with Ricky Fowler down in wherever the heck he and Smiley Kaufman and Justin Thomas were, you know, indicates that all of these people who were saying that this is going to scar him, that he's never going to come back, that, you know, this could be something that sends him spiraling for a while, I think they're all dead wrong, that we're going to see same old Jordan play extremely well at Oakmont. How about you?
I honestly don't know what it's going to do to him. I think that what has happened with Jason Day really taking a stranglehold on the world number one ranking is going to do more to Jordan Spieth than what happened at Augusta National. I mean, if you think about the last five major championships played, Spieth won the first two, won the Masters and the U.S. Open. He had the lead on the 71st tee of the Open Championship and let that slip away, not only on the 71st hole, but the 72nd hole. He found himself in the final group on Sunday of the PGA Championship, and no matter what he did, he couldn't stop Jason Day. Then he has a five-stroke lead with nine holes to play in the Masters and puts two in Rays Creek. So in his mind, he probably didn't think this was the first time he let a major get away from him. He probably thought this is the third time in a row he's let a major get away from him. And he's been in contention in each of the last three. So that leads me to believe that he is not worried about messing up in major championships. What he's worried about is that the guy who's going to chase him down for major championships or beat him out for him has the same short game that he does, but hits it 50 yards further off the tee, and that there's not a whole lot that he can do about it to get that much closer to him. So he needs to make changes in his swing, which he's pursuing right now, to get a little bit more consistent, to be able to work the ball both ways a little bit more easily, to not hit that weak fade in the most important moments. And if he can do those things, then he'll be a little bit more competitive at his best, to Jason Day's best. But what I think Jordan Spieth does better than any of the guys in the big three is his mental acuity, his ability to stay in the round, to stay in a shot, even when things aren't going well, and to kind of hang on. And he got a little loose with that at the Players, and he got a little loose with that at the Masters, obviously. But if he can tighten that up and remain the mentally strong player that he is, then I think he has a distinct advantage over Jason Day, who has a tendency to get a little whiny and a little wishy-washy when things don't go well.
You know, I'm not so sure that Spieth let that PGA Championship get away. He got steamrolled, okay? That drive, that 425-yard drive on 11 by Day, left Spieth looking at him, shaking his head and going, what? And left Day pointing at his biceps. And even Spieth said, there's nothing I can do about that. The other
I don't disagree with you in that sense. But if you're Jordan Spieth, the number one or two player in the world, you think that fate is almost always in your hands. And I think that is something that he had to wrestle with that afternoon at Whistling Straits. It's not in his hands, at least in that situation. So there was nothing he could do. He couldn't muster a 386-yard drive. He couldn't hole out from the fairway. He couldn't do all those things and make up that three-stroke deficit. And I think that, in his mind, he felt that had he been able to do something, he would have won. And that might have spurred him on to the changes that he's pursued in the offseason is dealing with now.
You know, he does have to look at Day as the primary right now challenge to him, along with Rory McIlroy, although Rory, you know, has not been as tip-top form of late as he's been. He's getting back there. I don't necessarily believe in this big three thing. I don't think there's a big anything right now. Okay, Rory's got four majors. Jordan's got two. Jason's got one. There's no big anything. Okay, back when we had a big three of Palmer and Nicklaus and Player, they must have had something like 22 majors between them. So nobody's a big anything. We're in a big repositioning right now. And a year from now, other guys will percolate up and other guys will percolate down. I like to take a wait-and-see attitude before I brand things like that. You know, because people kind of, I don't really see a need to have an immediate big anything. And for a while, we had CJ singing a big something. Okay, what a joke that turned out to be.
I think the notion of having a label is just for the sake of convenience. I think it's because people find it easier to talk about things in groups for however long they want to talk about it. But I think that fundamentally you're right. There's not – golf is a long game. There is a long game to view the sport properly. So eventually we'll figure out who – was there a big three? Was there a big one, four, ten? Were they the same people we thought it was in 2015 and 16 as it will be in 2017 and 18? And I think we'll get very different answers. And ultimately, in 5 years, we'll go, okay, well, so-and-so was great in 2015 because they proved out to be great in 2020.
Yeah, you know, a five-year period is the minimum that you need for a sampling. For example, the minimum number of times to figure out what the graded rough that Mike Davis instituted at the U.S. Open was a five-year period to start to get enough statistics to be able to analyze, and you need some more to look at it. Okay, for example, people were throwing Patrick Harrington's name around. Harrington is a big something, and he was up for exactly 18 months, you know, where he won those three majors. Hopefully he's running back into shape. But let's talk a little bit more about Jason Day and his performance at Sawgrass.
It was astounding. I mean, the guy played three tournaments that week, basically. He played the go-low version for the first 36. He played the harder-than-the U.S. Open version on Saturday. And he played the Goldilocks version on Sunday. And he won all three. And he won by four. I mean, that goes to show you how good of a player he is right now, that he was able to turn styles on a dime and hang in there and win. I mean, that means a lot. And he did it without his best stuff.
Yeah, and he should, therefore, be able at some point to complete a career Grand Slam because his game is broad enough and deep enough and versatile enough to play well on all four surfaces. to play well. You know, on the fast and firm conditions of an Open Championship course, he knows how to play well at Augusta. He should break through at some point. It would be a shock if he never wins the jacket. You know, the PGA Championship he's already got. And he can play tough, tight courses, you know, in challenging courses at the U.S. Open as well and contend as he's done before. Oakmont fits his game, fits Rory's game, fits Jordan's game. It looks like Oakmont is going to be a Donnybrook.
I think it's going to be a classic Open. I mean, there are just so many things coming together. You've got the two guys with the best short games on the planet that have either won or contended in the last five, six major championships. And they are going to be playing great golf on a firm and fast Oakmont test that will make sure the guy with the best short game that week wins. You can't ask for a whole lot more than that. And there's going to be a matter of accuracy because the rough looks pretty deep out there. It looks pretty juicy. It doesn't look like the graduated days earlier on in Mike Davis's career. If they think he is starting to adapt his setups to fit the venues better, to fit the style of the venue better. He's not trying to force feed a certain setup philosophy to a certain venue. And I think we're going to get a classic Oakmont Open where one under looks pretty good. And if that's the case, we should get a great championship.
I think we're looking more at 2 to 3 over to win this tournament. Remember, it's 5 over 1 last time. And now they've got something new that they're doing, which they are shading all the rough in front of the bunkers so your ball rolls in. And when I interviewed the head superintendent, John Zimmers, he said he believes Oakmont's bunkers are the deepest and most penal in the world. He said those guys will not be advancing the ball more than 150 yards. They're going to have to pitch out, you know, or risk hitting into the face. So something that otherwise might have been a little easier for them coming out of, you know, some of that rough, reasonable, you know, middle intermediate cut of rough near those bunkers is now going to be made, at least according to the USGA and according to the Oakmont Super, made a lot tougher.
And I think that's going to make for a fascinating – because – and you can do this at Oakmont. You can set it up this way, and it feels natural because everyone knows going in Oakmont's in the top five hardest golf courses on the planet. So
yes.
Going there, you expect it to be hard, and it doesn't seem
right.
Out of place for the USGA to do this, which I like. You should be able to do this every few years, have one that's really tough and exacting and exasperating, but not in the way the Chambers say
awesome.
Because the greens weren't so great.
And exasperating as well. Well, that's why we're going to see Wingfoot again in 2020, which will be a
right.
Wonderful sight as well. So it's like we're going to see Wingfoot this weekend. I will be going down on Sunday to Wingfoot to spend a day at the USGA Sport Ball, where they will be holding that on the East course. Everybody's had a chance to see the marvelous West course, you know, in all its U.S. Open might. But finally, we're going to see the prettier sister, okay? The dress is hard because the East course actually played a little tougher and scored a par at the 2004 U.S. Amateur. But it's, you know, if the, as I am putting in my article, which will be up at Golf News Network later tonight, I say if the West course is a fiery redhead, then the East course is a sunny, smiling blonde.
Well, I can't wait to see it on TV. I think that it, as you mentioned, doesn't get the acclaim that it deserves, primarily because it's not a U.S. Open host course. But it should be really fascinating for people. And I love that the USGA has come out of the gate with a four-ball championship at venues. I mean, we had Olympic last year, which was so cool for the guys. And then you come over and do Wingfoot this year. I think that's wonderful, and it really shows that the USGA is interested in making this championship special and have its own character at the same time. I think that's great.
It would be marvelous if the PGA Tour would institute a four-ball event sometime. How much fun would it be to see what teams would get chosen?
And there's my dog barking. But, I would love for the PGA Tour, and I don't know that we're necessarily all that far away from having this because of the new partnership with the LPGA. I think there may be a four-ball event coming between male-female teams or have two men and two women get together and they play different tee boxes on the same course at the same time. Not sure what it's going to be, but I think that that day is coming. I feel like that the governing bodies of the sport are starting to come around to alternative ways of playing and promoting those alternative ways of playing. So you've got the four ball with the USGA for the men and the women. The RNA is going to have its nine-hole championship, which I think is super cool. They're going to have that at Troon in the days before the Open Championship. You've got the USGA promoting Play 9. So there are so many things coming along, I think, where golf's governing bodies are going to get away from this idea of 72-hole individual medal play tournaments and start making it a little bit more fun and reflect the way the average golfer plays, which is outstanding. That's about time.
Which is what makes the Olympics so disappointing, that we're going to get another ho-hum boring 72-hole stroke play event. We're not even going to get a team thing.
That does bother me, and I think it also bothers a lot of the people who are playing in it, and I also think it bothers the people who are behind the International Golf Federation, namely the PGA Tour, the European Tour, the governing bodies of the sport. And I think that they made this call on a 72-hole medal play tournament with the hope that it would get them in, and that golf would just get behind
It did just the opposite, as people are saying, why should we come if it's same old, same old? But the other thing that people are very worried about is the water quality of Brazil is so horrendously unhealthy that a lot of people are deciding that they don't want to come. And on top of that, the Sochi Olympics is already rocked by a doping scandal. It may be that the entire Russian Federation may not be allowed to come with their track and field team. And now the announcement of a further investigation of Sochi Olympics, the Olympics are just reeling one after the other after the other with scandals and problems and protests. You know, it's almost like it's gotten too big and too much. And that's one of the reasons why golf did not need to be a part of it.
I don't think that golf is necessarily bad to be in the Olympic program. I don't think that's a terrible idea. It is a huge platform. Billions of people watch it. That's good for the sport, potentially. I'm not saying it's guaranteed to be, but potentially.
Well, I think it's good for the PGA Tour. I don't think it's good for the sport.
But how? I mean, the tour doesn't benefit from having golf in the Olympics. I mean, I don't think
money.
So. You're running the
money and exposure. And then, it built the brand. You know, that's the way that these intellectual property lawyer commissioners think.
But I think this was something Fincham wanted to have done before he quit. And now he's done it. Obviously, that's his kind of – this is his personal stamp. This isn't PGA Tour in the Olympics. This is golf in the Olympics. I think this was more of a personal satisfaction thing for Tim Fincham and a few other folks in the golf world, above all else. And
that's the problem, because golf's not supposed to be about your personal satisfaction. Golf is supposed to be about what you can do for the game, not what the game can do for you. And that's something I've always had a problem with Tim about.
I don't necessarily think that this is selfish to put golf in the Olympics. I would think just the opposite. I think that he truly feels that this will grow the game. Whether it does or doesn't, he's going to feel that way. And I don't think we will even know the potential impact of golf in the Olympics for 20 years, just like we talked about earlier. You're going to have a long game to figure out who's the best. It's going to take 20 years to figure out whether anybody picked up a club anywhere else in the world because of seeing golf in the Olympics.
We're going to have to go to a break very soon, but it's time for the JB's Best trivia question. Now, Ryan, since you're the editor-in-chief and the publisher and the chief muckety-muck and the grand poobah and all of that, if you were to win, it would look rigged. So even if you get the trivia contest question right, I'm sure you're the one who runs the station, that we have to have some sort of rules that say employees of, the families of employees are not allowed to win prizes. Am I correct?
Yeah, I would say I'm disqualified from winning the prize, but I'm happy to take part in any kind of trivia competition.
All right, so for JB's Best, so everybody else can remember how great JB's Best hot sauce is. The trivia, the category today is history and politics.
Okay.
This visiting dignitary and head of state was so short when she gave a speech at the White House lawn, the only thing visible was the top of her hat. Therefore, she was dubbed mischievously as the Talking Hat. Who is she?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer offhand.
This visiting dignitary was so short that they only could see her hat over the top of the podium when she gave the speech to the White House. Who is she?
I think it's between British folks. I'm going to go with Margaret Thatcher.
Oh, so close. I thought you were finally going to nail it. It's actually Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II.
I knew she was short, too. That was my other guess.
A.K.A. the Talking Hat. But you got to give her a lot of credit, okay? Yeah, I assume you might have seen the opening ceremonies of the 2012 Olympics in London where she and James Bond supposedly parachuted out of a helicopter and into the arena.
I did, yeah. I remember that very fondly.
Well, happy 90th birthday to the Queen as well. And so we are going to be back in a little bit with the second segment of the show. Ryan's going to come back. We're going to talk some more golf. This is Jay Flemmer. You are listening to Jay's Plays on the Golf News Net Radio Network.
That bump music means we're going to have to take a short break. Don't go away. We'll be back at the second half of the show in just a minute.
This is your main man, DJ Q, and you're listening to Jay's Plays on the Golf News Net Radio Network.